From Pennsylvania to New Mexico, Oregon to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, raising the minimum wage is not the best way to help those at the lower end of the income spectrum. Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with an alternative. It's called the For the People Act, but it is really all about protecting politicians. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The COVID-19 relief package includes a massive bailout of fiscally irresponsible blue states. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute. And defining what it means to be a conservative should revolve around taking the moral high ground on each issue. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Raising the minimum wage would help those who have a job, but there would be fewer jobs, thus trapping more families in poverty. But there is an alternative that would put more money in workers' pockets while not crushing job creation. Michael Farron is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He is here to explain. Michael, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Michael, before we get into the various proposals that are floating around relative to the minimum wage and possible hikes in that, tell us a little bit about the Congressional Budget Office and what that office had to say about the really negative impacts of raising the minimum wage.
The CBO scored President Biden's minimum wage plan as part of the that was proposed as part of the relief bill, and it found that by 2025, when the full $15 an hour minimum wage would have been enacted, that we would expect to see a 1.4 million reduction in unemployment and a $54 billion increase to the national debt as a result of higher prices associated with the minimum wage.
And what would happen to the actual workers? An increase in minimum wage is meant to help low-income workers, but also would it reduce job opportunities?
Absolutely. That's how the CBO arrives at the estimation that it will essentially destroy 1.4 million jobs that would have otherwise existed. The minimum wage helps the people that are able to keep their jobs, but it hurts the people whose job opportunities aren't there who would otherwise be there. So the CBO, to give you the whole picture, said that this plan would raise about 900,000 people out of poverty while at the same time killing 1.4 million jobs. So the end of the day, someone who's already working and can produce at least $15 an hour worth of value for their employer is going to be retained. But the people who can't produce that level, or the younger and experienced workers who are unlikely to be able to produce that level, aren't likely to be able to get their foot in the door to get the job training that would let them climb the economic ladder up to that $15 an hour minimum wage.
As you mentioned, there is a proposal by the Biden administration. We have, four proposals floating around now, including Republicans Mitt Romney and Tom Cotton proposing sort of a Biden light, if you will. Give us a brief overview of those four proposed plans.
Senator Romney and Senator Cotton's plan is, like you said, a Biden light plan. It would increase the minimum wage to $10 an hour by 2025. Rather than $15 an hour. And it would subsequently mandate that employers use the federal government's E-Verify system to ensure that their workers are legally allowed to work in the country. It's an aim to avoid enabling employers to use illegal immigrants or immigrants who are not allowed to work in the country in place of American workers. So that's the Biden light plan. The a secondary plan, as they called it, a Plan B by Senator Sanders and Senator Wyden, was proposed when the Senate parliamentarian said that Biden's $15 an hour minimum wage increase wouldn't fit into budget reconciliation, the Senate's budget reconciliation rules. And so that plan is imposes a 5% payroll tax penalty on quote, very large companies, although they don't define the size, that don't pay their workers some minimum amount, perhaps $15 an hour. That plan, as of recent reporting, suggests that it's that plan B is already thrown out because there's not enough support even for that plan. And then Senator Hawley, on the right side of the aisle, has an alternative then to Romney and Cotton's plan, where his plan says that companies with revenues greater than $1 billion must pay their employees a minimum wage of $15 an hour. So it's kind of similar to the approach of Senator Sanders and Senator Wyden then. But he would, for companies, small businesses would get what he calls a blue-collar bonus, which essentially provides a wage subsidy in the form of a quarterly distributed refundable tax credit for workers that would earn less than $16.50 an hour. Obviously, we're getting very much into the policy weeds here, but arguably that's the best part of any one of these plans, because a wage subsidy both increases labor supply by increasing the compensation that a worker would get for working, but also increases labor demand because employers actually benefit from the increased supply of workers, whereas the minimum wage increases labor supply because it increases workers' compensation, but it decreases labor demand because it increases employers' labor costs.
Talk a little bit more, Michael, about the alternative approach, which you've touched on here, of expanding the earned income tax credit as a way to help those workers who are below the poverty line without really tanking the entire employment system by making it impossible for employers to be able to hire enough workers.
So the earned income tax credit is kind of a lump sum wage subsidy, is what an economist would call it. It's paid out at tax time, and if your income is less than a certain threshold, and that threshold varies depending upon whether you're an individual worker, whether you have dependents, so it scales according to family size, then if your annual income is less than some threshold, the government will provide a tax credit, a refundable tax credit. So it means that they will likely give you a large lump sum of money to make up for the fact that your earnings did not meet that minimum threshold. Arguably, that's a much better way to go about supporting workers getting a living wage than a regulation that mandates that employers pay some minimum amount, because that, again, that minimum wage mandate decreases labor demand. So it's not a good poverty program because it shuts out some of the people that it ought to help. And even better, the earned income tax credit essentially targets the exact people that you would want to help and can be tailored to target them even better because you're focusing on people with dependents, children.
We have been talking with Michael Farron, who is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Michael, tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go on the web to read about this and other issues?
You can go to mercatus.org. That's mercatus.org. Mercatus Center is an academic research center located at George Mason University. And we bridge the gap between academic research and ideas and public policy problems, trying to communicate the bottom-up solutions that benefit everyone in the society, as opposed to top-down solutions from federal government.
Again, we have been talking with Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center, that, of course, at George Mason University. Michael, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much, Loma.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, joining us as he does every week. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin our discussion by talking about H.R. 1, which is named, as the left often does, the deceptively titled For the People Act. What does this bill actually do, Scott? And it really isn't very much for the people, is it?
No, it's not. And what we're calling it is Pelosi's election fraud bill. This legislation would dramatically change the way that elections are administered in the United States of America. And we think that it would codify election fraud throughout our country. It's a slap in the face of election integrity because it's going to dismantle states' rights in enacting their own election laws, including voter ID laws. And we think that it would create new opportunities for the sanctity of one person, one vote to be compromised under the false premise of election access. The bill is really an attack on the First Amendment, and it would totally change political speech. The right of the American people, in our view, is to be able to criticize election officials. And I think that's what separates us from countries like China and Venezuela and Cuba. But the legislation would take away that right by drastically changing reporting requirements for Americans that are exercising political speech. Pelosi's election fraud bill unwinds the First Amendment by empowering the Federal Election Commission to track political speech and low-dollar campaign contributions. And it also requires that disclosure of Americans that donate to charitable and nonprofit organizations. So that's a real problem, right? Right now, you can anonymously donate to a lot of organizations that engage in political speech. But the bill also requires an extension of early voting, allowing same-day voter registration, which obviously can allow for even more voter fraud. And the Pelosi election fraud bill prohibits election observers from coordinating with election officials to file formal challenges to suspicious voter registrations. And it even makes it a crime to discourage somebody from voting. So a lot of folks are concerned about over-criminalization in federal law, and this is just another step forward for that.
As you mentioned, Scott, this does take aim at the First Amendment. Should this actually manage to get through Congress and be signed into law, sounds to me like fodder for a major case before the Supreme Court.
Well, it passed the House this week, and how the Senate decides to take it up, certainly you would have cloture, meaning the 60-vote threshold for the Senate to proceed to the legislation. But another key element here is that there's political welfare for politicians. There's up to $6 for every $1 for a candidate that's a taxpayer subsidy, which means taxpayer money would fund even more of what they disagree with, including candidates for federal office. I think that Chuck Schumer might try to bring the bill forward just so that they can say that the Republicans blocked it. But unless they find a way to bring it on another reconciliation package in the coming months, it'll most likely fail in the Senate and die.
Moving now to political developments, Senator Rob Portman, Republican in the state of Ohio, which is a rather dependably red state, although not totally, he decided to retire at the end of this term. There's been some maneuvering to be his replacement. Some developments this week. Tell us what happened.
I do think that Ohio is a pretty red state at this point. President Trump won the state 53.3% to 45.2% in 2020. And Rob Portman was a two-term senator that announced his retirement effective at the end of this Congress, 117th Congress. Josh Mandel was previously elected statewide in Ohio as Ohio's treasurer and also served in the Ohio legislature. Club for Growth PAC previously endorsed him in 2012 and 2018, but he lost a pretty close race in 2012, and unfortunately in 2018, he withdrew from the election, citing his wife's health issues. So Mandel's a Marine Corps reservist, served 8 years as an intelligence specialist, 2 tours in Iraq, and we think that he's a very strong constitutional conservative with a reputation as a fiscal hawk. He believes in limited government, balanced budgets, transparency, and really on transparency, one of the big things that he did as treasurer was he opened Ohio's checkbook by putting all of Ohio's spending online, despite firm opposition from John Kasich at the time. So, you know, he's sort of a good government, transparency Republican that I think will work well with the people. Mandel is also a really strong conservative compared to the rest of the field, and we're looking forward to supporting his candidacy in the months ahead.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as usual, tell us a little bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 500,000 members from all 50 states in the country. Today, I talked a little bit about Club for Growth PAC and the endorsements that we make for federal candidates. If you want to learn more, you can check us out on our website, clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott, thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
It is called the American Rescue Plan, but might better be known as the Blue State Bailout. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine finds out why from Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute.
The Senate is likely to vote before the end of this week on this massive $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. It's not even really a COVID relief bill. It's just a massive bundle of government spending on a whole bunch of things, most of which don't have much, if anything, to do with COVID. One of the things that does have at least some tangential connection to the pandemic, however, is this $500 billion that's going to be sent to state and local governments, ostensibly to help them paper over holes in their budget due to the response to the pandemic. But how much of that is really necessary? And can't states handle their own budgets and their own finances? That's what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest is Chris Edwards. He's the Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and a friend of the program. He's been here several times before. We welcome him back now. Chris, thanks for taking some time with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric.
$500 billion in this COVID relief bill, $350 billion of it is going to state governments. That's more than basically everybody says is necessary. Like even the progressive groups are out here saying that's about twice as much as the COVID hole that state budgets are facing. Why so much money in this, Chris? What is going on here with the state bailout?
Well, there's absolutely no reason for this additional state money. I mean, federal bailout packages during 2020 already handed state and local governments around $400 or so billion dollars. There's wide agreement now that state and local budgets were nowhere near as hard hit by this recession last year than a lot of people initially thought. So here's the way you can think about this. Separate out state and local governments. Local governments are primarily funded by property taxes. In fact, about 3/4 of local government tax revenue comes from property taxes. Well, housing prices were soaring during 2020. In fact, they are up 15% on the year. So that means property tax revenues have been pouring into local governments over the last year. So local governments generally are not short of money. And then state governments, it's true they lost a little bit on sales tax revenue last year, but income tax revenues were up substantially. So overall, if you look at calendar year 2020, tax revenues for state and local governments across the country were actually up 1% over 2019, despite the fact that revenues dropped a bit in the second quarter, but came soaring back during the third and fourth quarters. And so then if we look ahead for 2021, the Congressional Budget Office expects GDP growth to be a really strong 4.6% this year. And if that's true, then income and sales tax revenues will continue growing. So state and local governments do not need this money. It is true that there's a few jurisdictions like New York City that have shot themselves in the foot with extensive shutdowns and bad economic policies in general. But the great majority of states and local governments are doing fine and will continue to do fine and don't need another bailout.
One of the issues that's come up in the debate over this bill, and this was raised by Chris Sununu, who I think was actually Cato's number one governor in America this past year, the Republican governor of New Hampshire. He raised the fact on Twitter that the allocation of dollars here is based on the state unemployment rate or the number of people who are unemployed. And so effectively, that means what? That this is a transfer of money from states that have managed the pandemic more effectively to states that have instituted these like ruinous economic lockdowns.
That's right. There's a lot of parts of this that essentially reward the bad behavior of state government. So the more you've done shutdowns, the higher your unemployment is, and then the more money you're going to get from Washington. Well, that's unfair to the states that were better managed over the last year. And then secondly, states are supposed to build up their own rainy day or savings funds during the good years. And we had a decade-long expansion when most states, to their credit, did build up rainy day funds. But there was a number of states, like Illinois, New Jersey, for example, that saved absolutely nothing during the good years, and they went into the recession last year with absolutely no savings. Well, we shouldn't be rewarding bad behavior by bailing out states that didn't save for themselves.
We're talking with Chris Edwards. He's the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute, also the editor of downsizinggovernment.org. You can check that out for all sorts of cool data on the size of the federal government. Pretty depressing data for the most part. Chris, just about a minute left here. Let's finish by sort of pulling back here. Big picture, this is a $1.9 trillion bill. That's a ton of money. All of it is going to be added to the national credit card. This is all deficit spending. Is it wise for Congress to be engaging in this sort of behavior right now when we're already $27, $28 trillion in debt?
No, the United States government has put the nation into a unique peril we've never seen in our history. Our government, federal government debt is higher than it's ever been now as a share of the economy. Some economists naively say, well, you know, interest rates will stay low, but we don't know that. Economists are lousy forecasters. We've got this $20 trillion national debt. Now, if interest rates and inflation rise, we may well run into a big financial crisis that will crash the American standard of living for years to come. I mean, a decade ago, Greece went into this big financial crisis, and it caused years of pain and hardship for average Greek citizens, and their standard of living now is lower than it was before their debt crisis a decade ago. We don't want to go in that direction. Federal policymakers ought to be prudent and start reducing this deficit rather than increasing it.
Yeah, and that's really the choice. Any clear-eyed assessment of this bill has to take into consideration that, right? That every dollar you send to a state government right now, the dollars that in many cases they don't need, is a dollar that you've got to pay back at some point down the road, another dollar added to that future debt crisis that we could be facing. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Lots of interesting stuff here, and we'll have him on to talk about it again next time the federal government's going to spend a bunch of money it doesn't have. Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Eric.
And again, that is Chris Edwards. Check out his work at cato.org and at downsizinggovernment.org. He is the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
In the wake of the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol, conservatives must find a way to separate themselves from those who engage in such actions. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA explains how to do that on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The modern American conservative movement was born in the 1950s, led by a pair of bookish intellectuals, William F. Buckley and Professor Russell Kirk. Buckley's start was his book God and Man at Yale, and the magazine he started, National Review. Kirk's was his seminal opus of conservative principles, The Conservative Mind. It's the book that not only laid the foundation for modern conservatism, it also connected it to an intellectual tradition that went as far back as Socrates in the 5th century before Christ, and was especially tied to the 18th century Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. As my friend Lee Edwards at the Heritage Foundation wrote, "Since its founding, America had possessed a conservative patrimony that was the equal of the liberalism said to be the only intellectual tradition in America. While conservatives from John Adams to Nathaniel Hawthorne to T.S. Eliot seemed to be acting in splendid isolation from each other, they were in fact joined in their preference for the old and tried against the new and untried." It took Kirk 4 years of research and writing to connect the dots of the seemingly disparate thinkers and writers. The result became The Conservative Mind, a surprise hit among books on history and philosophy. Phyllis Schlafly, Barry Goldwater, and Ronald Reagan stood on the ground solidified by Russell Kirk, and thus the American modern conservative movement began. It would eventually grow to a functional political majority that not only elected presidents and governors, but even dominated the U.S. Congress and Senate for a time, and more than half of the state legislatures. It developed its own popular and highly profitable media, such as Fox News and Rush Limbaugh's talk show. But the question before us in the year 2021 is whether it became increasingly corrupted by the lust for an exercise of power in its name that it both exploded and imploded on Capitol Hill on January 6th. Where were the descendants of Burke and Buckley that day? Did the modern conservative movement die that day? I've been a conservative most of my active political life, and I've always considered the conservative political movement to be intellectually sound, resting as it does on more than two millennia of great thinkers who produced effective results. I'm also a Christian, and for most of my life I have considered political conservatism and evangelical Christianity fundamentally compatible. Were the rioters who stormed the Capitol on January 6th conservatives? I'd say not. They were more anti-intellectual than intellectual, and even if they bore some of the symbols of Christianity, their actions that day certainly did not reflect the teachings of Jesus Christ. Yet the self-appointed, morally conceited, and newly woke national media delighted in disparaging the conservative movement by identifying those thugs with us. Maybe we need to find a new name. We most certainly need to regroup as a movement. Just as Kirk and Buckley did in the 1950s, we need to go back to our intellectual forebears and reorient our movement to the true north of our philosophy. Who do you admire most in our movement? Is it Donald Trump and Sean Hannity? For me, it's leaders like Senators Tim Scott, James Lankford, and Ben Sasse, and former Vice President Mike Pence. None of those is perfect, of course, but they seem to be approaching their responsibilities from a sincere effort to determine what's right, not just what's expedient politically. So I've tried to find a simple way of finding that true north. The concept I've landed on is indeed simple, and I'll concede that it may also be somewhat simplistic, but it's helping me reorient myself and figure things out. It's the simple quest for the moral high ground. Where's the moral high ground in the abortion debate? Where's the moral high ground in the immigration debate? Where's the moral high ground in the drug debate? Where's the moral high ground in preserving social order? Where's the moral high ground in helping the poor afford the necessities of life? Where's the moral high ground between economic dependence and independence? Where's the moral high ground in civil rights? Where's the moral high ground in human rights in international diplomacy? Where's the moral high ground in international sovereignty? Not everyone will agree on the answers to each of these questions, but let's agree on the questions. They're helpful. They help frame the issues of public policy in ways that are more likely to be unifying than most of the questions we hear from Washington and state capitals today. The civic values and virtues that are formed by answering these questions will be more in tune with traditional conservatism than traditional liberalism. At least I think they will. But the political label we put on them is of little consequence. It's having the perspective to ask the moral high ground questions in the first place that can put us back on the right track as a nation. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WKTS-FM in Kingston, Tennessee, WWTM-AM in Decatur, Alabama, along with WYTK-FM in Florence, Alabama. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.